difference to be the last meditation of this retreat, having spent 3 days contemplating the nature of living and dying, and understanding that the moment of death is really the most important time of our life, in terms of having the awareness present, or the changing point of our future. As we mentioned, the moment of death is sort of determines how the mind will carry on in the future. And the idea about unfinished business, the purpose of our life should be to tread the noble path and try to make as much progress as we can, on the path to freedom from suffering. And especially with most people, they have a lot of trouble with anger and resentment, and having ill will towards various people that may have hurt them, crossed them, caused them suffering, whether it's in their family or people at work or just in general, anybody else or groups of people, and harboring that resentment toward them, and keeping them out of our heart. And we call that the unfinished business. If you're not able to accept everybody with loving friendliness and open the heart, then there's no way that you can really attain liberation from the mind, because this energy of ill will or resentment is going to be the unfinished business that will cause you and probably other person as well to come back to resolve your issues. And so on, as you can see, is what happened in many of the stories and the Buddhist text between people. So anyway, the forgiveness meditation is very powerful, in that whenever somebody causes us some difficulties, like even in those minute meditations I was talking about earlier, that whenever somebody causes you some trouble or you get angry, you should forgive them as quickly as possible, so it doesn't stick in your mind and then build into resentment. And the way that we forgive people is understanding that basically everyone is sick. Everyone is sick with their own greed, hatred, and delusion, and they're going to do things that disturb us, just as we have done things to other people probably that have disturbed them also. And just as you would like to be forgiven, the same way we should forgive others, and not to wait around until the other one sort of apologizes first, but basically in your mind. And even some people might have already be out of your life, not around, even dead perhaps. But if you're still holding any ill thoughts toward them in your mind, that is still that unfinished business. So the practice of forgiving others for things that they've done to you, and even asking their forgiveness if you have done things to them that made them angry, and then forgiving yourself. Because some people blame themselves and keep beating themselves for having done something unskillfully in the past that they're regretting. So you also have to forgive yourself, to learn how to forgive oneself, knowing that we're also still sick. Until one has attained at least the stage of the anagami, you know, everyone still has the sickness of greed, hatred, and delusion to one extent or the other. And so we're all like patients in a hospital. So to treat others, you know, understand and forgive, have compassion and forgive them, even if it's difficult. So that we can, you know, drop that burden of the heart, of this hardness towards, you know, certain people. And then after doing the forgiveness, then spreading out the thoughts of metta. If you're still holding grudges, then it's almost impossible to spread metta. But once you've gotten rid of those grudges and memories, then the metta can more easily flow out. So I'm going to kind of just talk you through this as a kind of a guided meditation. But you might start just remembering, especially some certain person maybe, or situation that you might still be having some difficulties with in not forgiving them. Maybe some of you have already overcome that. Maybe you don't have any particular persons, but probably most people have some kind of a situation. So anyway, you can recall that and then use that as the object of your, and also yourself. So go ahead and just take up your meditation posture. And try to sit comfortable but relaxed, but also keeping the body straight. Just begin again with a few more deep, slow breaths. Draw the attention inside. Just feel your own body sitting there, sitting and breathing. And just seeing your own body sitting there and knowing your life, and the problems that you still might have, you're trying to work toward purifying the mind, cultivating metta and wisdom. But then, again, remembering some situation, some unpleasant situation, or argument, or fight with some person, family member, or other, or it could be just some group of people, maybe who didn't do anything to you particularly, but maybe that you have ill will towards, what they've done to others. And just sort of ponder that situation. And especially if it was an argument, personal argument, or fight with somebody. Recall that situation. Try to visualize the person's face standing in front of you. If you can't visualize the face, then just remember it the best you can. Just try to see the pain in their own face. Know this person, they suffer from their own greed, hatred, and delusion. And we're all conditioned by society. Nobody is an evil person deep down. That only ignorance and conditioning is evil. But each person has the Buddha nature within them. So just continue to look at that person's face and just tell that person, I forgive you for what you've done to me or my loved ones. I know you didn't do it on purpose. You were driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So I really forgive you. Even if it hurts, just keep on saying, I forgive you. Start to see that person's face, their reaction. Just try to open your heart a little bit more to that person. I forgive you. Just a little bit more. I forgive you. Just try to really empty out every last bit of resentment, ill will. And then continue to look at that person and ask for their forgiveness. Even if you think you may not have done anything, it always takes two people to get into an argument. Just ask them to forgive you. Please forgive me. Just look into their eyes. Whatever I might have done, I did that out of foolish unmindfulness. Out of my own greed, hatred, and delusion. I now know better. Please forgive me. And now, sort of remember your own actions in that situation. And try to visualize your own face. And sort of look at your body sitting there. Try to look in your own eyes. Forgive yourself. I know I was foolish in that situation. I'm trying to improve myself now. Just forgive yourself. I'll try better to be more mindful in the future, not to commit the same mistake. Forgive myself. And just try to feel the lightness or the relief of that burden of holding on to that ill will, to feel the heart more open, feel the sensation in the body and mind, that opening, letting go of that hardness. And take a few more deep, slow breaths, feel the expansion of the heart, the chest, the free flow of energy. We shift our focus to cultivating metta to ourselves and others. Just think along these lines to yourself. May I be free from attachment and greed, anger and hatred, jealousy, envy, fear, pride and ignorance. May I be free from the pain, sorrow, and sufferings of body and mind brought about by such unskillful thoughts, speech, and actions. May I have the patience, the strength, the mindfulness, and wisdom to meet and overcome all difficulties in life. May I overcome the fear of getting old or sickness, and even death. May I be able to continue to deepen the practice of Dhamma, to deepen the practice of meditation, to free the mind from suffering. May I be well, peaceful, and wise. In the same way, may my parents, other family members, children, husband, wife, aunts and uncles, relatives, teachers that I've had in school from childhood to the present, other Dhamma friends, may all of them be free from greed, hatred, fear, and ignorance. May they be free from various pain, sorrow, and sufferings of body and mind, brought about by unskillful thoughts and actions. May they also have the patience, strength, mindfulness, and wisdom to meet and overcome all difficulties in life. If they haven't already, may they also be able to learn and practice the Dhamma, learn and practice meditation, to free their minds from suffering. May they be well, peaceful, and wise, and kind of think about all the ordinary, common people out there in the world that are working, struggling to make ends meet in this difficult time, undergoing all kinds of hardships, obstacles, suffering. May all of them be free from greed, hatred, fear, and ignorance. May they be free from the pain, sorrow, and sufferings of body and mind, brought about by such unskillful thoughts, speech, and actions, their own actions, and by the actions of others. May they have the patience, the strength, the mindfulness, and wisdom to meet and overcome all difficulties in life. And if they haven't already, may they also have the precious opportunity to hear the mind-healing teachings of the Buddha, to learn the Dhamma, to learn and practice meditation, to free their minds from the wheel of suffering. May they be well, peaceful, and wise. May all the rich and famous and powerful people in the world, those who influence others, control people's lives in different ways, the rulers of the world countries, may all of them also be free from greed, hatred, fear, and ignorance, free from pain, sorrow, and sufferings of body and mind. May they also have the patience, strength, mindfulness, and wisdom to meet and overcome all difficulties in life. May they be able to make the right and wise decisions that bring more happiness and less conflict in the world. May they also be able to hear the mind-healing teachings of the Buddha and start practicing the Noble Eightfold Path and meditation to free their minds from suffering. May they be well, peaceful, and wise. You can try to feel your heart beating in your chest. Just imagine with each heartbeat sending waves of metta outward in all directions. Just like radio waves going off of a radio tower. With each breath, with each out-breath or each heartbeat, sort of imagining waves of thought, waves of metta, friendliness, radiating off your body and mind, and spreading out across the whole country, the whole earth, back to Sri Lanka or other places where you're from. Just imagine that energy permeating the bodies and minds, all the people, all the animals, even going up to the Deva realms, and down to the ghost worlds, and the hell, spreading that out in the 10 directions, the north, the south, the east, the west, and all points in between. So with the thought, may all beings in the entire world, the entire universe, whether visible or invisible, living near or far, weak or strong, rich or poor, may all living beings, may all creatures, be well, safe, secure, and happy. May all beings be free from physical sufferings, mental sufferings, inflicted by themselves or by others. May all beings have the patience, strength, mindfulness, and wisdom to meet and overcome all difficulties in life. And may all beings have the precious opportunity to hear the mind-healing teachings of the Buddha, to learn the Dhamma, to follow the Noble Eightfold Path to the end of suffering. And may all beings be able to live peacefully and harmoniously together, understanding the ultimate interconnectedness and the interdependence of all things. May all beings be well, peaceful, and wise. Just like a mantra reverberating throughout space. Well, peaceful, and wise. Well, peaceful, and wise. Well, peaceful, and wise. No. What is the best way to get rid of sleepiness while meditating? How can we get our energy back? I think I went over this in one of the last days. There's many reasons for sleepiness. Even though you might have slept for 8 hours, and you still, then you get up and you meditate, some people still go to sleep. But I mentioned that the main things is the first to check the posture, because it's 9 times out of 10 you're not sitting straight. You've allowed the body to slouch. So try to straighten back up and take a few deep, slow breaths. Try to breathe in a really deep breath, holding the breath, even try to get the air into the upper part of the lungs and hold it in as long as you comfortably can, until maybe even you feel yourself starting to sweat just before you pass out. But you know, not to that extent, but do that several times until you feel a kind of cloud or haze of sleepiness passing off. Of course, it may pass off for a short time, and it may come back again. And you can try massaging your neck muscles, where the muscles that join the head to the body, give them a massage, and maybe get the energy flowing more. Or massage sort of the face, press the eyeballs. If you have some water, drink some water. Or you can also open the eyes. One of the first things you can do is, if you open the eyes and try to meditate, keeping the eyes open about halfway, especially if there's some light, let some light in the room or so, then that might help you to stay awake. If that doesn't work, if you're still sleepy, then try standing up, because the fear of falling down will help you to stay awake. If that doesn't work, do walking meditation, especially preferably outside in fresh air. Do some deep, slow breathing. Or maybe do some yoga exercise. And then try sitting again. And if that doesn't work, the Buddha recommended, laying down to rest for a while, laying down on the right side, but not with the intention to sleep a long time. And take a little rest, and then try it again. Or one of the antidotes for laziness or sleepiness, as I mentioned, also you could try meditating on at the edge of a tall building, or the edge of a linda or something, where it's going to keep you from falling asleep. But we should also know what induces that sleepiness, like overeating or maybe eating impure foods, just mental thinking. A lot of, if you're angry and you're worrying and have anger and worrying, that also drains our mental energy and can cause sleepiness. We're always worrying about things and so on. Oh yeah, then to, of course, contemplate about the death. Especially that's for laziness, to overcome laziness, to get the urgency not to, laziness, which it also means like indulging in sleep, too much sleep. Another one. Isn't it better to go for sleep when you are angry? Because during the sleep, you don't collect any bad karma. Please explain. It's better to try to overcome your anger before going to sleep, because that anger might come up in your sleep. The bad dreams or some restlessness. So it's better to at least let your anger subside by doing some of the things we've already talked about to overcome anger, and so that you, anyway, that you calm down a bit, and then perhaps then if you need to go to sleep. But it's not good when your mind is full of anger then to try to sleep at that time, because it will probably take you a long time to do that, and you haven't at least resolved like, you know, practice forgiveness and, you know, metta and so on, and calm down. Because if you just go to sleep when you're angry and sleep, you're kind of ignoring the anger and not sort of dealing with it in a skillful way. You're trying to just push it down, and when you get up again, the same situation or individual gonna get you angry again. When someone else needs help, if we do metta meditation, can we transfer that energy to that person at that time? Please explain. Well, you know, our thoughts can have effect on other people. You know, there's been experiments done in this, even with things like plants. You know, there's some experiments done even with water. There's a famous Japanese researcher who did some experiments and you know, with like even water crystals, and he was thinking pleasant and nice thoughts to the water, and the crystals, you know, had some kind of shape, and then he thought angry, hateful thoughts toward the water, and they changed their chemical structure based on just the change of tone of the thoughts. And also with the people, that two people that have been having a lot of ill will, there's been psychological research done. Let's say a man or woman were fighting for a long time, they wouldn't hardly speak to each other for a long time, and when they came home, the other one hide in their room and, you know, hardly ever meet. And then one man went to a psychiatrist, and this person suggested, you know, sending metta to that, his wife. And so even though it was painful, he forced himself to send some metta. And after a couple, he didn't tell the wife what was going on. You know, wife didn't know any. He was seeing a therapist or anything. And after a couple of days, he noticed that, you know, his wife kind of was out a little bit more and would, you know, come out of hiding, and he would see her a little bit more, and, you know, the strong tension wasn't so strong. And after a few more days of continuing to practice the metta, you know, that situation kept improving. And even after some time, they started, you know, exchanging highs and, you know, some pleasantries. And after some more time, the wife even, you know, had some tea ready for the husband when he came home, and basically they were able to patch up their relationship just on this. And the wife didn't know that her husband was sending metta, but it's the power of the thought. So yes, the thoughts can have some benefit, but it may not overcome a person's sickness. Let's say if a person is sick, you know, has cancer or something, and you send them metta, I mean, it may help them to some extent, but it's not a guarantee or anything that's going to actually cure the person's sickness. But it will help you, your own mind. Metta is practiced not only, we send it to other people, but actually it's a way of healing our own mind. It's an antidote for ill will, actually, not for curing somebody else's sickness or something else like that. It's for curing our own sickness of ill will and resentment. However, these thoughts can have their effect, and that's why you should not harbor ill thoughts to anybody, because if you've read the Petavatu, the stories of the ghosts, so many of those ghosts who are suffering did so because they held some negative thoughts toward the people before they died, like not forgiving them and having ill thoughts. And they were reborn as pretas in different situations, and especially having ill thoughts toward virtuous people and so on. You know, people that were angry at the Buddha and Arhants, and, you know, they suffered a lot. So anyway, the whole point is to guard our thoughts, and that's the point about preparing oneself for death. You know, we don't know when we die. We want to free our mind from any ill types of thoughts, whether it's anger or any other types of negative sorts of thoughts, because that can have an influence on the mind. Please give us your blog address. For those that don't know, I have a blog on the blog. Basically, it's a way for some of my students around the world to kind of keep up with where I've been traveling or retreats that I'd be teaching, in the future in some different places, and some reports about some of the places where I've gone, to teach retreats or visited. And then it also has actually four of my books are available to download from the blog, as well as links to a number of YouTube videos where I'm giving some Dhamma talks, and other links to sites where a lot of my Dhamma talks from different retreats and so on are there, as well as some articles and the chantings and chanting tapes. There's a number of things that one can download from that. So anyway, I'll after we're done, I'll try to write that out if anybody's interested in that. With so many things to learn, whether it be Dhamma or the school, how can we make our memory better? Sati. The basic definition of sati, mindfulness, is memory, to remember. Just as I mentioned, if you walk in, you put down your keys, but you don't really see clearly where you put them, you won't remember it, because we weren't mindful. But when we do things with mindfulness, then you're apt to remember it better. Like even studying for school, you study your lessons. What do? You try to cram for a test, right? Or read a chapter. But, you read a few words and your mind starts thinking about something, or you bring it back and mind keeps wandering. And so you read down at the end and you hardly can remember anything you read, because the mind was distracted. So you have to go read it again, sometimes three or four times, before you remember the things. So if you practice meditation and you learn how to tune out distractions and check your thoughts, that when you concentrate on a subject or any kind of work, the reason why we make mistakes is because in some moment we're unmindful and weren't aware mind was lost, and you made a mistake. Maybe cutting vegetables and you cut your finger or something. So mindfulness is really the key for improving so many things. But when you're really mindful and you really see the words that you're doing and comprehend it, then it would be easier to remember that. Or in any other type of work. But it's basically, the learning is difficult because the mind is distracted by so many hindrances. That's why, the monks in the old days, they learned, memorized sutras, and some of them memorized a whole Tripitaka, massive amount of things to memorize. But, they could memorize it because their minds weren't cluttered up with so much rubbish and so on. I mean, in the old days when they didn't have so many distractions, but now people are so distracted, and especially students, they're always chatting and texting and involved in all this Facebook stuff, and they're just really distracted. And so that takes away from the mind's power to be attentive and to remember. When I meditate, sometimes random pictures or faces come to the mind. What am I doing wrong? How to fix this? You're not doing anything wrong. It's natural, random faces and pictures will come, because in our unconscious mind there's a steady stream, a continuous river of past images and memories from, you know, basically all of our past lives, but especially probably within the current ones. But some things we don't even recognize. And they may come in meditation, but we use insight to know that, you know, this is simply a mental phenomenon, and not to cling to it, not to have fear about it, and it'll just arise and vanish. And, you know, they can't do you any harm unless you start to identify with it or react to it in some way. And if you don't pay attention, they'll mostly subside or stop. But especially when you get into deeper meditation, you get down into the unconscious, and that is where these images and so on are coming from. You know, they call it nimitta. Nimitta means a mental image. And when you're practicing, let's say, jhana concentration, a nimitta can come. That's also but it's an image like a little light or a star or some kind of a counterpart image of the object you're focusing on. And then one can focus on that. But that's a specific type of practice, but still it's coming from the same thing. It's something that produced from the mind. But all the other sort of random ones, even if you see a monster or the face of the Buddha, you know, basically it's just these are the mind creating these things. And you know, we shouldn't really cling to them, because otherwise they'll keep coming. So you're not doing anything wrong, but just be mindful when they come and just keep coming back to your primary object of the body or breathing or whatever your specific meditation subject is at that time. Or if it's just anicca, just see it as anicca and let it go. But, you know, if you look at too much internet, you're looking at all the, you know, the hundreds of friends on your Facebook and all their pictures that they're posting up, most of it rubbish, that, you know, these things are going to stick in your mind and they're going to keep coming back. That's why it's a hindrance. Because anything you come in contact with, whether it was listening to the news, watching all these things, are going to be in the mind, and they have the potential for will come again. And so if you want to be free from them, don't feed your mind full of so much of this unnecessary stuff. It may be nice and this and that, but it's going to be create this kind of hindrance. Although if you ignore them, they'll eventually go away within 1 or 2 days. Normally they would stop coming. When I am doing walking meditation, I concentrate on the sensations in my feet. The awareness seems to penetrate down to the bone, and in my mind's eye, I see my feet in a skeleton form. I would like to know what I should be doing next. Well, it's sometimes true, especially if people have imagination or some other factors, that by contemplating on the body, you might see the bones, because the bones are there. It's like having X-ray vision. And that could be frightening to some people, but, you know, some people use that as it's like a nimitta. Basically, the mind is creating that. Because of your knowledge that underneath the skin there's a skeleton, the mind can create. And again, as I mentioned, that's how the Venerable Tisa attained enlightenment. So, you know, if you see the feet in the skeleton form, the next step would try to be see the whole body as a skeleton. Just a walking skeleton. And it creates a lot of detachment in the mind. And it can, basically it's used to create this detachment. You know, not to get stuck on the external forms of the body. And so, people with a lot of lust and attachment for bodies, if they develop that kind of nimitta, like Tisa did, then if you have you're looking at somebody and you notice some desire arising, and then you can flash or superimpose that nimitta on the person, and then any desire for that person based on their hair or skin or eyes or any external features would vanish. So that's one benefit of doing that. So if seeing the body as a skeleton helps you to stay focused, but it's mainly the insight that comes from that. And especially it's sort of to see the emptiness. It's just a walking skeleton powered by greed, hatred, and delusion. And you can let go of that identifying it as me. And you could have even an anatta experience. Is there a book on dependent origination that is written in plain English in an easy to understand manner? What is the difference between mind and consciousness? Is vijnana the consciousness? Actually, I think I already actually talked to this person and answered their question. Maybe some other people have an interest in the same question. In the first part, is there dependent origination in plain English? Well, you better ask Bhante Ji to write one. He seems to be the expert in mindfulness in plain English, and jhanas in plain English, and everything else. So maybe you'll write a book on that. But the Buddha said this Dhamma is deep and profound. It's not easy to understand. But of course, the most easiest explanation of dependent origination is simply because of this, that arises. When this is, that comes to be. When that ceases to be, this ceases. When that disappears, this disappears. Basically it can only be understood when you sort of contemplate it and think about each of the topics. You have to think about ignorance. What is ignorance? All the different aspects of ignorance. And how does that produce the karma formations? How does that produce the consciousness? So it helps to have at least some intellectual understanding of some of the terms. Otherwise, it would be confusing. What's the difference between mind and consciousness? The vijnana. Vijnana, consciousness, is one of the five aggregates. As I mentioned before, we cling to it as being I, me, and mine. That means we think I am the owner of this consciousness. It's I that am hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. But consciousness itself basically is just the light of the mind. It's the knowing faculty. The ability to sense anything. Without consciousness, we'd basically be dead. in terms of any consciousness of the world. But consciousness is again just the sort of the light. But the mind, the mental factors of the mind in the nama rupa, the nama means feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. So there's four elements of the mind. The consciousness is sort of like the bubble. And feeling, perception, and volition are the contents, are the things that activate that consciousness. Otherwise it would just be a light that doesn't know anything, doesn't do anything. It's just a light of awareness. Without any sense of I in it, without any volition or movement. But without the consciousness, then of course feeling, perception, and volition wouldn't be aware of them. They wouldn't really function. So, normally when we say mind, it includes, you know, the consciousness, but it's the mental activities are what give consciousness its particular flavor. It's a consciousness with greed, it's a consciousness with hatred, it's a consciousness with confusion, it's a concentrated consciousness, a distracted consciousness. That's the cittanupassana. So citta often is a synonym also of the consciousness. But basically consciousness, mind, we basically use the term meaning the same thing, but it's good to, especially when you're, because the mental factors have, different activities, to understand the difference. But you'll only know that when you develop a deep state of concentration in which those mental factors are not so active. And especially when the sense of I weakens and starts to dissolve, then you can experience basically what we sometimes call pure awareness. In which there's no desire, there's just the awareness of sounds and sensations coming and going, but there's total equanimity, mindfulness and equanimity. But there's no greed, hatred, there's none of these mental factors in activity. So you're experiencing more the purified consciousness as opposed to the polluted consciousness with the activities of greed, hatred, and delusion. When somebody does manipulating things on a daily basis, and you know you are going to be taken advantage of, and it's unavoidable, how do you keep your mind calm? To meditate. If you meditate on a daily basis, hopefully you'll have mindfulness to not to get so upset. Of course, naturally, only an arhat probably wouldn't get irritated if there was somebody doing that sorts of things. So at least we have to sort of manage our irritation and manage our anger. Because naturally in this world there's all kind of unpleasant things going on, and as long as one is still not reached at least the stage of once returning, or sotapanna, then you don't have much control over your actions and mind, so that these things will still happen. But at least with mindfulness and concentration and wisdom, we can manage it. So at least that irritation that we feel is not going to turn into some karma. You know, you might have the grasping of aversion, you know, and be tempted to punch him in the nose or, you know, whatever. You know, sabotage his computer or something. But then you have to reflect on, you know, the cause and effect. And if you do that, then there's going to be repercussions and you're going to get some suffering back from that. But the best thing would be try to, you know, send them metta. The person's probably doing these things because, you know, maybe they feel that anger from you. Again, just as that example I talked about, the husband and wife. So send them metta. And maybe you'll unconsciously, or she, will get that feeling and slowly maybe not do so many things to irritate you. When speaking of the heart in meditation, does it mean the same as the mind? Must have been reading the Forest Dhamma books, because it's only the Thai monks, the monks in the Thai forest tradition like Achan, especially Achan Man and Achan Mahabua, maybe Achan Cha a little bit, but it's mostly the books of Achan Man and Mahabua in Thailand, or some other of those disciples who use the term heart when talking about samadhi or the mind. But usually in other, you know, Buddhists and scholars, they don't use that term, the heart, so often to refer to the mind. But generally when you they're talking about that, it refers to the pure mind. So when they're using the word heart, they wouldn't be talking about the negative mind states. You'd be talking about the more pure mind states, such as samadhi, when the mind is, you know, attained the samadhi, and, you know, the knowing comes from the heart and so on. But it's because in Abhidhamma, the mind, the seat of the mind, is said to be the heart base, or Hridayavatu, which they translate as heart base. But it doesn't necessarily mean that physical heart that pumps blood. Same way as the eye base is not the actual physical eye, it's the very subtle nerve endings and so on. So the same way with the heart base is not necessarily the physical organ of the heart. Thinking that the mind is in that. Because otherwise what happens when somebody gets a heart transplant? They don't have a mind? Or they get somebody else's mind? Anybody know somebody with a heart transplant? What does Rahula mean? That's my monk name. That was the name of the Buddha's son. I think you all know the story. I don't need to repeat it, you know. But. So he called his son a hindrance, meaning a Rahula is born. But it comes from the Vedic mythology of Rahu, the god Asura Rahu. And it said that during the full moon, Rahu swallows the moon. Not the full moon. The eclipse of the moon. When the moon gets covered and sort of disappears, and the light of the moon goes out because the sun goes in front of the moon, or the earth goes in front of the moon, or however it is, anyway. He said that Rahu has swallowed the moon. It means in the dark phase of the moon, not the full moon, excuse me, the dark phase of the moon. So it's an obstruction to the light of the moon. So Rahu is, you know, this Asura obstructs the light of the moon. So it came in popular usage to be like a hindrance. And so the Buddha used that in terms of his son. You all know the story that a hindrance is born. But Rahula became a Samanera at the young age and was known to always want more training. He didn't want to be known as the Buddha's son and get special favors from the other monks, but he was the Buddha's son, right? You know? So he even slept in the toilet and so on. And, you know, he... And then later, of course, he became an arhant, I guess, at a fairly young age. And so anyway, but my, you know, I got that name when I got ordained. So, you know, I usually identify it as, you know, son of the Buddha. Just in that way of wanting to do more practice. It's a long, kind of an experience described. Last night I had a dream. I was in an association just like the one today and listening to Dhamma talk. A thought came that I don't believe that anyone could fly with psychic power. Then one of the Buddha's disciples asked me to hold on to one of the upasikas. I did, and this yogi flew high in the sky. I hanged on with my eyes tightly closed and scared. Then we came down. I argued with the disciple that the Buddha forbid to display any power. What is the significance of this dream? Did you drink any whiskey? I'm joking. You know, dreams are, you know, strange phenomenon, and you know, it's difficult to try to explain all the symbolics, the symbolism of dreams. Usually they're in symbols. But even the Buddha displayed psychic power in order to cure the skeptics. You know, in order to help people to gain faith, you know, he performed some psychic powers. If he thought it would help that person to gain faith in the Buddha or the Dhamma and practice, he used it sometimes. And, you know, it works. Look at Sai Baba. You know, even many Sri Lankan Buddhists go to Sai Baba. Because he can do, you know, when he was alive, you know, do certain so-called, you know, psychic powers. So, you know, they got inspired by that and think, wow, he must be something, you know. And let's face it. Look, right now there's, you know, just you are in this room. If I went down in downtown Toronto and levitated and flew around downtown Toronto and the Trump Tower and so on, and you know, I came down and then, you know, created and gave everybody a diamond ring out of nothing, and this place would be jam-packed the next week. Of course, maybe for the wrong reasons, but you, so you kind of get people in with these sort of psychic powers and then preach them the Dhamma. And then if you have that kind of psychic power, hopefully you have the better psychic power of learning, of to be able to preach the Dhamma in a way that converts people to the Dhamma. And that's the Buddha said the highest psychic power is the ability to teach the Dhamma in a way that gets people, gets their faith, you know, to practice. So, anyway, you know, usually with dreams, you don't try to put too much into the dream, but, you know, it shows that, you know, there's something that's in your mind, or something you're trying to figure out or aspire to, or some sort of quality that's in you is kind of being sort of illustrated by, you know, this dream. Like, especially people who are starting to tread the spiritual path, they'll have these kind of dreams that indicate where their mind is trying to go. Like, you might have a dream of yourself watering some plants and watching them grow up quickly and bear nice fruit. So, you know, maybe that's a symbol of, you know, you're striving to practice the Dhamma, and and to water the seed of, you know, faith and mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Like that, just for an example. Or, you know, defeating ones. Or maybe you had a lot of snakes. Snakes might mean the defilements in your mind. Might be the snakes crawling around, and you know, you got frightened of them. Might mean that we still have these defilements in our minds. So, like that, there's a lot of symbolism in the dreams. The whole science of dreams, of course, is New Age and so on. A lot of people make a big deal out of it. But basically, they're just mental phenomena and dhammas. Once I asked another monk about non-veg foods, what was his thoughts about eating meat? He said that what goes into your mouth, it does not matter, but what comes out of your mouth matters. What are your thoughts about non-veg food? Well, that's true. What comes out of our mouth is more important than what goes into it. But you know, that's sort of a hot button topic these days amongst Buddhists and others. You know, of course, people that are attached to eating meat, you know, they're going to defend that by any number of types of statements and so on. I myself became a vegetarian. In the beginning, it was because when I was traveling in India and I was traveling across Asia and I was eating a lot of contaminated meat in like Arab countries and shish kebabs and meat markets were all covered with flies, and I got terribly sick for many months until I went to a yoga ashram and kind of purged everything out and got over that, and then I stopped eating meat after that, and then that was before I was even a Buddhist, really, and then understanding about metta. So anyway, my take is on it that if one is a Buddhist and you're practicing metta, then you know there is a reality about, you know, supply and demand, right? If there's a demand for meat, somebody's going to be killing the animals, right? So if we're part of that demand, you could say in a certain way we are indirectly, karmically connected to that. I mean, one could make that argument. And so to have a clean conscience for yourself, then, you know, that's up to you to decide if you want to stop eating meat. As well as, you know, there's said to be sicknesses also can come to eating meat and so on, and, you know, other types of things. There's so many arguments, pro and con, of course. But nowadays you can get plenty of food that has good protein in it without eating meat. You know, I mean, maybe 50 years ago or in Sri Lanka, maybe where things were limited, you know, like before imports came and this and that, or like in places like Tibet or in countries where it's difficult to grow a lot of vegetables and so on, and you know, eating meat might have been more necessary. But I've always wondered, look at, an elephant is the biggest animal on earth, right? And they weigh a ton just eating grass, tree branches. So if and they live 100 years. So if an elephant can be that strong just eating grass, why do we have to eat meat? You know, I've always wondered about that, you know. All these animals that just eat grass, you know, they survive. So, therefore I think eating meat is overhyped. And, you know, a lot of animals suffer If you go to some of these abattoirs and places where they kill animals, you know, there's horror stories come out of those places about how animals are treated. So how can you practice metta and compassion to all living beings, wishing them to be free from suffering, when, you know, your demand for the meat causes these poor animals to be flogged and suffer in so many ways? Anyway, that's just my argument. It can be debated. But, you know, each person basically has to settle that for themselves, you know. And, you know, to be with your own consciousness about it. About why do you want to eat meat? Because when you die, you might see a piece of meat in your mind as a nimitta, like your favorite sirloin steak or something, or a chicken wing. Uh-oh, got the nimitta. Might be the sign of destiny. Okay, so that seems to be all the questions. So I think we're going to bring this weekend, 3 days of meditation to an end. And as you've already mentioned, you've created a lot of merit by spending 3 days in meditation. And, you know, there's a Dhammapada verse that states that, you know, spending 1 day in meditation is karmically better than living 100 years without meditating and without following precepts and without being calm and relaxed. You know, just 1 day of living disciplined and meditative is worth more than 100 years of living without it. With, you know, or seeing impermanence, just living 1 day observing impermanence or anatta is worth more than 100 years of living without that kind of wisdom. And as I mentioned before, we're practicing Dhamma, whatever we do, the merits we accumulate, you know, they automatically go out and are shared with everyone else because it's bringing more wisdom into the world and less greed, hatred, and delusion is polluting the atmosphere of the world. So, you know, that's the way that we share the merits. We help ourselves as well as helping others. So people who help themselves, the Dhamma, help others, either directly or indirectly. And when you help others in terms of kindness and generosity, practicing dana and loving kindness, then you're also helping yourself to cultivate those qualities. So we've already, you know, did that sharing of merits, at the lunchtime puja. But also the wisdom that you cultivate, the verse that, you know, we practicing by the power of the merits of this Dhamma, you know, may I not have to associate with foolish people that are always trying to drag us down. And may I always be able to encounter wise persons and have association, contact with the Dhamma to help lead the mind eventually toward the stages of enlightenment in Nibbana. So we can just chant that one verse again to that aspiration. Imina punyakamena mame bala samagamo satan samagamo hotu yava nibbana patiya. Many monks who went from this country, and you know, out of the generosity of the hearts of the people, not only Sri Lankans but people all over the world, you all know that, you know, the generosity really poured out, and so monks sort of, you know, spearheaded a lot of these village rehabilitation schemes, and for rebuilding the houses that are broken. And so I also went to the I didn't ask for any donations, but people knew I was going, and they wanted to collect some money, because in my autobiography I lived in this the Devala, the Valley Devala at Unawatuna. It's quite a well-known place. And in August every year, they have a festival with fire walking and all these things. But anyway, I had a kuti there, and I spent many months and had very powerful meditations meditating in that Devali, especially in the Buddha Gaya of the Devali. But the tsunami washed right over the top of that Devala and washed the roof off of most of the buildings and broke the doors, and it didn't like totally destroy the place, but they, you know, it badly damaged it. And so out of the gratitude for that Devala and the Buddha Gaya having sheltered me, and the people there providing dana or many months or even years of meditating, I did what I could.
Having read your first book, we realized the transformation that you went through, and now having associated with you, we know the great transformation on the path. And we also heard that you have relinquished your ties after 26 years at Bhavana. You are free like a bird. So you are no longer having any attachments, no ties. But I know you will respond to other invitations and maybe come back some other time. And you are to have a retreat in Ottawa, and when is that, sir?
October 25th to November 1st, 1 week retreat at Where is it? In Hull or someplace?
In Hull, yeah. Just the border of Ottawa. So we wish you rapid progress on the path that you will cut all those fetters and attain Tirunuvanmaan in this life.
Sema Veva Nyalam Sapadla Beva. Now when you know, when people respond and are truly, you know, grateful for the teachings, that's what inspires or, you know, motivates, you know, teachers to continue to, you know, to want to share the Dhamma.
Will there be other Bhante Ramas, Bhante Gunaratanas, Bhante Dhammajivas in the future?
Take it upon as your challenge. Everybody's asking when other people are going to do it. We have to ask ourselves, I'll do it. No, not necessarily. In my own way. Because traveling around, you know, the way I do, it's, you can't really follow those dutanga practices in kind of the sort of strict way and so on. But I do, you know, to a certain extent when I can. Anumodam. Sadhu sadhu dadam. Abhivadana silesa nicchang vadda pachayino chattaro dhamma vaddanti ayo vanno sukhang balang. Ayurarogya sampati saga sampati mevacha ato nibbana sampati iminate saminjatu bhavata sabha mangalam rakkantu sabha devata sabha buddhanu bhavena sabha dhammanu bhavena Vena Sabha Sangha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantuti.